Within NATO, for example, the United States still accounts for 70% of total defense spending among NATO states. But if you then look at what does the United States spend directly on European security, which is what NATO is meant to be concerned with, or Euro-Atlantic security, it is pretty clear that that percentage of US spending that is directly invested in Europe is actually just a fraction of that. I mean, we estimate it to be around 6% or less than 6% of total US spending. So it gives you a slightly different measure of the burden sharing debate, or a different angle on the burden sharing debate, if you look at it from that angle. So there's some interesting things going on, but there's clearly also a bit of regional variation.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 23rd, 2019. Each year, the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London publishes the Military Balance, an annual assessment of the military capabilities and defense economics of 171 countries around the world. Last week, I sat down with Bastien Gigerich, Director of Defense and Military Analysis for IISS, who leads the research and publication of the Military Balance, which has just come out for 2019. We discussed Chinese military modernization. We discussed global defense spending and how it's changing around the world. We discussed Russia's violations of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Agreement. We talked about NATO, and we talked about cyber. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 394, Bastien Gigerich on IISS's 2019 Military Balance. Let's start with what the military balance is in general before we get to this year's edition of it. What is it?
Well, it is an annual publication that we've been doing since 1959. So this year's is the 60th anniversary edition, really. And it started out as a 11-page pamphlet in 1959 that looked at the military balance of power between the Soviet Union and NATO at that time. And it has now evolved into a 500-600-page long study covering 171 countries around the world and looking at their military capabilities, their force structures, their defense spending, their military activity. So it is now, it has morphed into over time into what I would call both a reference work for data on these subjects, and it is also a piece of analysis in its own right, where the research team, the defensive military analysis team here at the IISS, puts forward its analysis of what's going on in the military and defense field.
And it has been published every year since 1959?
Yeah, every year since 1959. Every year it has gotten a bit longer. And now we have reached a length where our publisher tells us you cannot have more pages. It has expanded over time. We have added countries to our analysis over time, and now we have the book, and we have a sister product which is called the Military Balance Plus, which is an online database that removes some of these physical constraints that we have with the book, so that we can do yet more work. So that's what keeps us busy all year, frankly.
All right, so let's talk about what kind of information as a general matter is in the military balance. If somebody picks up this large volume and starts flipping through it, what's in it in terms of, like, what countries does it cover and what sort of information does it have about those countries and their military?
Yeah, it covers pretty much every country in the world that has armed forces. With very few exceptions. The Maldives are not in there. I've been lobbying for a research trip, but so far that hasn't been approved. But we do cover over 170 countries, so there's a lot in there. And when you look at these at the information on these countries, what you will find is information on defense spending data. You will find information on equipment holdings for these armed forces of these countries. So what kind of tanks do they have, what kind of airplanes do they fly, what kind of helicopters, and so on and so forth. You will find information on their force structure, so how many people are in their armed forces. You will find information on how their services are structured, what kind of roles do their forces fulfill. Do they have a naval infantry, for example? That's all the kind of information you can find out. And that is data that we present in country form. And then there's a lot of analysis, obviously, drawing on that data. That is then written analysis, essays that we put in the book. And they can be on cross-cutting themes, for example, on nuclear arms control or on cyber and defense, things like that. And they are paired with regional analysis where we look at what do we think are the main trends in European defense this year, in Asia Pacific, or in the Middle East and North Africa. So we go around the world basically and try and provide the best open source, it's important to say it's an open source product, the best open source assessment of these themes around the world.
So let's talk about the sourcing for it. I was going to turn to that, and you conveniently did it for me. A lot of countries have a lot of relatively open data about their militaries and their capacities. Some countries make a point of overstating their capabilities, and some countries make a point of understating their capabilities or concealing their capabilities. And some countries do a combination of all three. That is, you put out a lot of information, you overstate your abilities in certain areas, you conceal or understate your ability in other areas. So if you're working off of a trying to create an open source product that evaluates and analyzes lots of countries' capabilities and forces, which open sources do you use, and how do you evaluate whether a country that claims to have X ability in fact actually does, or whether a country may be concealing a very significant capability in area Y?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent question, and it is as much as an art as it is a science. I guess you can guess. And what we do is really we stand on three main legs, so to speak. One is, as you might imagine, we engage all these governments that we are covering, so to speak, or the countries that we're covering, in a dialogue about our data, and that is probably where you have what you described, where some countries are very transparent and present data that you can check up on, that you can validate independently, whereas others give us data that is, shall we say, misleading in one direction or other, and then there is, of course, a group of countries that doesn't do anything and does not help at all. But we need to have that dialogue with them to engage them, to see what can be gleaned from that direction. And then, of course, we do all the open source analysis that you would imagine a think tank does. We look at, of course, the specialist literature. We look at satellite imagery. We look at YouTube videos of conflicts, of military parades, of bases, of all sorts of things that we can find to identify whether a new unit has been stood up, whether a piece of equipment has been delivered, that kind of work. And then the third leg is a network of international, I don't know what the right term is, but maybe international correspondence almost, where we engage a group of experts around the world to help us with specific data questions that we have. They might be on a particular military service in a particular country, or it might be on a particular piece of military technology. So we involve a much larger group of people in trying to help us come up with the best possible open source assessment. So what is important to understand is that what we publish is our analytical judgment. It is not simply publishing what someone gives us. So we might receive information from a government on a particular piece of capability, but then publish something that is different from that if we come to the conclusion that it needs to change. So to give you an example, we have this year published with the book a big wall chart, a big poster, basically, providing the force laydown for China's armed forces. And so what we've tried to do is locate different units, locate the roles or identify the roles that they have and what they are called. And it's a map with a couple hundred data points on them. And for each of these data points, we needed to go through that process where we had to identify where that unit is, what it is called, what it does, whether it's still there, whether it has moved, all these kinds of things that we will verify independently through these three strands of inquiry, so to speak, and then form a judgment and then publish the information.
So before we turn to sort of major findings and takeaways from this year's report, I'm interested in, you know, if you're dealing with 170 countries and you're trying to dialogue with a bunch of them about the findings that you're developing, there must be some that are kind of particularly rewarding to deal with in the sense that they're transparent and open and there's a constructive dialogue to be had, and some that are frustrating and difficult. And I'm kind of curious whether that tracks the sort of democratic, non-democratic divide. Which are the countries that, you know, every year putting together the section on these countries and their military capabilities is a pleasure to work on, and the governments are fun to engage with and largely truthful, and which are the ones that are like IISS's enemies because they're super opaque and frustrating and they lie?
Well, you know, I mean, you're right. The countries that are the most forthcoming and are the most transparent are the ones that you suggested. They are, you know, roughly the Euro-Atlantic countries, and then countries in the global Anglosphere, whereas countries in certain parts of Asia, in certain parts of the Middle East, are very hard to penetrate from an information point of view, where even an extended dialogue over years where we try to engage, re-engage, yields little in terms of official information documentation provided. I think that's actually something that's been relatively stable over the years for us. So there hasn't really been a lot of movement in terms of, you know, transparency hasn't increased in a market way. And funnily enough, if anything, we have seen some of the countries in Europe actually look at the information they provide to us. And we had some of them question whether they should really help with as much detail as they have in the past. And funnily enough, curiously, the rationale for these countries was that they felt the security environment had deteriorated around them. There was again a challenge of conventional military conflict in Europe, and maybe it wasn't good anymore to be as transparent as they have been in the past. So you have actually perhaps a counterintuitive trend that some of these countries that have been very transparent in the past are now looking at whether they should be as transparent as they have been. And that for us, of course, we try to abuse them of that sense that they should be less transparent, because our whole mission is anchored in the belief that by providing reliable information of high integrity, we can contribute to better decision making, and as it is stated in the original mission of the ISS, to civilized international relations.
All right, so let's turn to how the military balance is different this year than it was last year and in previous years. What are your big takeaways?
Yeah, I mean, one storyline that has emerged for us over the last two or three years, I would say, is really about the spread of high-end military technology, and the fact that leads to more capable weapons being in more places and being used by more people. And that is, of course, one of the main takeaways linked to then the fact that the Western military superiority in technical terms, in technological terms, is eroding somewhat, is being challenged by countries such as China. And that has important implications for how the West, you know, North America and Europe largely think about how they use force and how they have, you know, become used to using force over the last 2 to 3 decades, operating from that assumption of technological superiority. So those are some of the important changes that we've seen. And related to that, we have looked quite a bit at Chinese military modernization, which we find is rather striking, both in its ambition and in the speed with which it proceeds and develops. And if you look at China's defense spending, for example, in the past decade, it has grown by 8% in real terms every year for the past 10 years. It has only now, well, actually the 10 years to 2017, the last year it has slowed down a bit, but still growing by about 6% in real terms. So you know, there's an accumulation of money happening there that is significant and that is leading to rather impressive progress in China's military modernization, even though there remain some rather stark weaknesses as well. But those are the kind of trends that we're looking at. We've looked at global defense spending trends again, which have in 2018, global defense spending has reached 1.67 trillion US dollars around the world. This is 80 billion more than the previous year, so about a 2% increase. China's defense spending obviously continues to rise and contribute to that, but a significant chunk of that global increase also reflects higher spending by Western states, and they're notably the United States. The difference in nominal spending year on year, 2017 to 2018 in the US, has been $45 billion. That's roughly the same as the entire German defense budget. And if you just took that increase by itself, the $45 billion, that would have been the 10th largest defense budget in the world in 2018, if you just looked at that. And then, of course, one of the other main elements that we looked at in the global picture this year has been Russia, Russia's continuing military modernization, and of course the controversy around the collapse and the material breach of the INF, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, based on the development and deployment of the what is called the SSC-8 screwdriver ground-launched cruise missile.
All right, so let's take each of those three in turn. At Chinese military modernization first, how should we understand China's military capacity at this point? Is this now have they reached the level of sort of global superpower? Are they still a kind of regional, major regional power? You know, how should we think about where, you know, we always talk about sort of China's rise, but the question of rise to what strikes me in military terms as an important one. You know, you say they really have some very impressive capability at this point, but still some areas of weakness. Kind of assess them for us. How should we understand how they stack up?
Sure. I mean, at this point, China is still far from being a global military power, just to make that clear. I think what we have seen, though, is President Xi Jinping and the Communist Party express a very clear vision of where they want to be in the future. And that vision has two deadlines attached. The first deadline is 2035, by which China wants to have modern, capable armed forces that, in effect, would be dominant in their own region, and by 2049, they want to be able to have a world-class military that basically can challenge and win wars globally against whoever might be the opponent. So that might sound, from a Western point of view, that might sound like a very long timeline, but it reflects the amount of work that China still needs to do, and it reflects that there is a long-term vision relating to where China sees itself in the future. But if we look at what they have done, I think there's still notable progress. So, for example, in the naval field, our assessment is that China has entered a new phase. You know, it's now designing capability to facilitate long-distance missions, long-distance deployments, and an increased tempo of operations. So it's building large, high-capability surface combatants and have really done a lot around naval shipbuilding, both in terms of tonnage launched and just in terms of the size of some of these platforms that they are building. So that is notable. China is not yet capable of sustaining high-end and long-range maritime operations, but it is beginning to build the capability to do that. On the Air Force side, we see notable increases in China's capability for tactical air combat. Its J-20 heavy fighter is now entering frontline service. There are some notable guided air-to-air missiles that are also entering service, and those things together amount to a considerable improvement in the Chinese Air Force inventory, and from our point of view, at least provides China with the ability to contest more effectively the regional air domain in its part of the world. I mean, I think it's notable that China, for now, seems to have halted its land reclamation and island building program that has sparked so much controversy in the South China Sea. But it's not a good news story, because it is now concentrating on building up military facilities and weapons on those features that it has built. And China is developing and is indeed already fielding weapons that would complicate the plans of armed forces that would try to enter the South China Sea. So, for example, the United States, particularly when that happens under combat conditions. So those are notable areas of progress. I think the weaknesses for China, they probably lie around training. So, you know, the skills of the personnel, so to speak, they lie around enabling platforms such as air-to-air refueling tankers, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance platforms, logistics vessels, those kinds of things that you would need if you wanted to run expeditionary operations over long distance or wanted to engage a peer or near peer adversary. And I think for China, the long range trajectory is positive in the sense that from the perspective of China, it has shown it can innovate. It has shown that it can make progress. What it lacks almost completely is combat experience and the ability to actually put this capability into action. So that would be my China assessment. In the long run, a development that one needs to pay close attention to. Some notable progress, but some persistent weaknesses.
So global defense spending, I guess the top line that you described is that it went up, which is hardly a surprise in periods of tension where the U.S. is, among other things, putting pressure on allies to spend more.
Yeah.
Is there anything surprising going on in the global defense spending area, or is it just doing more or less what one would expect it to do?
No, I mean, it's doing both. It is in part doing what you expect it to do. So, for example, the rise of defense spending in some of the Western countries that I've mentioned before, I think, you know, that is in line with policy, and that is in line with a perception that the security environment has become more challenging. And it comes at a time when a lot of these countries, in particular in Europe, have more fiscal space again, have come out of a setting of austerity and therefore can afford to spend a bit more. So that's all pretty much as you would expect, I guess. But you do see some interesting developments elsewhere. So, for example, in Southeast Asia, Defense spending on the regional level has declined year on year, not by much, but a little bit. And I think it's an interesting reminder that strong economic growth, which we've also seen in that region, does not necessarily translate into strong defense budget growth or indeed high levels of defense expenditure. So there's it's a reminder that these things are not necessarily linked. If we look at the Middle East, for example, we have the countries where we can measure it in the Middle East and North Africa, defense spending fell by 12% between 2017 and 2018. It's obviously a conflict-ridden region, but we've seen cuts to the budget in Saudi Arabia. We have seen fluctuating exchange rates that obviously, if you measure in dollar, also contribute to the overall regional decline. But we also see countries simply spending less on defense. Iraq spends 10% less in nominal terms in 2018 than it did in 2017. So you can see some interesting trends and some interesting divergences if you move around the world. And in part, this is of course related to conflict in the region, or improvements, or an escalation. You can see that in defense spending. But the overall trend still seems to be one on the global level where we have an uptick. And I mean, it is interesting to see that within NATO, for example, the United States still accounts for 70% of total defense spending in among NATO states. But if you then look at what does the United States spend directly on European security, which is what NATO is meant to be concerned with, or Euro-Atlantic security, it is pretty clear that that percentage of U.S. spending that is directly invested in Europe is actually just a fraction of that. I mean, we estimate it to be around 6% or less than 6% of total U.S. spending. So it gives you a slightly different measure of the burden sharing debate, or a different angle on the burden sharing debate, if you look at it from that angle. So there's some interesting things going on, but there's clearly also a bit of regional variation.
So let me ask you a different way to formulate the European defense spending question, which is, if you ask the question of what percentage of the cost of the defense of Europe is borne by the United States versus European countries, presumably it's neither 70% nor 6%. Where does that fall?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, so what you need to look at for that is the direct spending, which is, as I said, direct U.S. spending, which is around 6% of U.S. spending, so about, what is that, about $36 billion roughly. And then you would have to factor in what of the remaining U.S. force structure that might not be in Europe, that might be somewhere else, including in the, the homeland U.S., would be brought to bear in case of a European defense mission, collective defense mission under NATO. And there the estimates vary a bit, but I guess a rough estimate would be to say that about 25% of U.S. spending would be attributable to that kind of scenario. So out of about $643 billion in 2018. So that is a significant number. That contrasts with a total of European NATO member states defense spending of about $264 billion. Now you can of course say, well, not all European spending is on European defense either, but I think the percentage that you would need to attribute is a lot higher, simply because pretty much all European countries do not have the kind of global obligations and the need to provide a security presence in pretty much every region of the world that the United States has.
Let's talk about Russia. You mentioned the intermediate range nuclear force treaty controversy, but I'm interested also in Russia's general military capabilities right now. We talk about them in the United States these days as though they were 10 feet tall and made out of offensive cyber operations.
yes.
But, it's also a country with a declining population, a serious set of sanctions against it and a long-term failure of economic performance. And so I'm curious, how is the Russian military faring in all of this? And are we overstating sort of in our anger in the United States at Russian interventions in the 2016 election, something that, you know, people in Britain know something about as well? Are we kind of overstating the magnitude of Russia's military capabilities, or have they really successfully managed to preserve a kind of world-class military in the face of a general economic decline?
Yeah, I think, you know, I said about China, it has a long-term trajectory that from a Chinese point of view is positive in terms of military capability, but lacks experience. Russia is the other way around. Russia has now probably the most capable armed forces it ever had since the end of the Cold War. But its long-term outlook is clearly bleak for the reasons that you've mentioned. So it is the mirror opposite almost of the China assessment. And you mentioned we shouldn't pretend the Russians are 10 feet tall. I think that's absolutely right. They have gained from their point of view, useful operational experience in Syria, in eastern Ukraine. They have done a lot to rotate crews and senior officers through, in particular, the Syria theater. They've done a lot to use Syria in a cynical way, almost as a weapons laboratory, a test and evaluation center, to make judgments about technology, about doctrine, about training, and that is clearly beginning to pay off. So in that sense, they have that going for them. But we do see the budget under severe pressure, the defense budget, for, you know, the reasons that you mentioned, economic troubles, sanctions, and other spending priorities that are creeping up. So we do think there is a fork in the road here for Russia, where it needs to decide whether it wants to actually spend money on defense innovation or whether it wants to spend money on modernizing the armed forces with the kind of current plans. And we see Russian military modernization has begun to slow down. The delivery of new and modern equipment across the services is slower, is behind the plan that Russia has put in place. So I think it's fair to say that we should have a more nuanced understanding of that Russian military modernization than we sometimes get. Having said that, we do see, for example, in Crimea, Russia activating a new airborne unit. It has modernized a key air base. It has complemented the replacement of its S-300 air defense system with the S-400, more modern air defense and more capable air defense system. So that is all going on, and really provides a whole new set of capability around the Black Sea region that is complicated to deal with. They have also continued to develop and deploy new nuclear and dual capable weapons. There has been a lot of talk about the Avangard hypersonic light vehicle, which reportedly entered series production in 2018. And of course, there is the 9M729 ground launched cruise missile in NATO parlance known as the SSC-8 screwdriver, which is the system that led the US to say Russia was in fact in material breach of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. And all of those developments are of course worrying. So I think, you know, the short term worry is certainly Russia. The long term worry, I think, from the United States is very clearly China.
Finally, let's talk briefly about NATO. We talked about sort of NATO burden sharing and defense spending, but I'm interested in your, assessment of, you know, all the talk about NATO these days is about, you know, sort of tensions within the alliance and sort of, you know, how European actors are responding to Trump's kind of demands on them, but also, you know, his raising questions about United States commitment to NATO. lost in this is how NATO shapes up as a fighting force at this point, or maybe latent in it, since we all kind of assume that the answer is that it is at this point without compare. And I guess my question is that assumption right, or are there aspects of it that we should look at in terms of, you know, a less than stellar long-term prognosis?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And to me, it seems that there's an interesting dynamic at play where you have, you know, below the political discussion and the high-level heads of state and government and ministerial discussion, you have an organization, NATO, that has actually been relatively organized and coherent in responding to the Russian challenge since 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea and started fermenting unrest in eastern Ukraine. And it has worked through from 2014, the Wales summit, to the Warsaw summit in 2016 and the Brussels summit in 2018, through a range of measures that strengthen NATO's deterrence and defense posture. And they have to do with rapid response, they have to do with reinforcement plans, they have to do with increasing spending, they have to do with developing high-end forces and redeveloping a NATO command structure that can actually support the movement and sustainment of large formations for collective defense purposes. So all of this is going on. All of this is coherent and actually systematic. It might not be perfect, and it might not be the final answer, but it is actually a systematic effort to work through the problem. And then you have on top of that an alliance that looks on the political level incredibly brittle and fragile, actually. And with every meeting, European heads of state and government in NATO wonder whether President Trump will blow up proceedings and, you know, say things like he did in Brussels last year. Well, maybe the U.S. will go off and do its own thing. And that creates, that instills a sense of fragility, a sense of uncertainty that makes people in Europe, at least, begin to hedge their bets a little bit. It makes them think like, well, maybe we should reinvest in European defense efforts in the European Union. Maybe we need a plan to come up with alternatives when the U.S. commitment is perceived to be uncertain. And I think that for a political military alliance such as NATO is actually very difficult to deal with. So there's the threat from you know, external actors that NATO is actually proving that it is willing and to a degree also able to deal with. And there's the challenge from within. And I think NATO struggles much more to define an answer, a convincing answer to the challenge from within. And I think, we just had last weekend the Munich Security Conference, where we had, again, a string of senior European leaders speak about the need for the transatlantic alliance to stand together in face of a multitude of threat and an increasing number of issues to worry about. And we had a U.S. vice president giving a speech which was read by many people as either you're with us or not. And there wasn't really much of an option there for Europeans, which I think is disconcerting and I think deeply worrying. So I think as NATO is moving towards its 70th anniversary in April, and will celebrate its 70th anniversary, underneath that layer of activity and the glue that holds it together on the working level and on the military level, there sits a political conversation that is deeply worrying and does not bode well for the long-term health of the alliance.
One last question, and then I'll let you go. Somewhere in these 520 pages, there is there is a different book that is entitled The Cyber Military Balance. And I am interested for your encapsulation or summary of that book. You know, if you take only the parts of the military balance that relate to cyber capabilities, defensive and offensive, what does that picture look like globally from your point of view?
Well, Ben, that's interesting because that's the book we're in the process, still in the process of writing. What we do cover in the military balance as it stands now, the military balance 2019, is an assessment of cyber doctrine, cyber strategy, the organizations that and commands that people have built up. What is on our to-do list for 2020 is, in fact, to develop metrics to make cyber capability that can have a military effect measurable and comparable, so that we can do for cyber what we can do for the other military domains, such as air, land, sea, space, and so on and so forth, and make it comparable and give people the ability to rank and come to grips with that global story as it unfolds. That's on our to-do list. That's actually not exactly a trivial question and not exactly a trivial problem to solve. A bunch of us are actually heading off to a workshop at the end of this week to start this work, where we will try and come up with a draft methodology to do this, which will then go through different iterations here with the research team so that we can start producing data and case studies later in the year. And then if all goes well, and if we have the same conversation in February 2020 about the military balance 2020, then I will have a fuller answer for you, and hopefully we'll be able to give you data around that. Because as military capability develops and as new fields and new areas of data and capability emerge, we obviously need to adapt. And cyber currently poses perhaps the biggest challenge there to make that into a data set that we can use just in the same way that we assess other domains, other military domains, and provide the factual basis that people can base their analysis on.
I look forward to having this conversation again when you guys do that. And thank you in the meantime very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't done so yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a rating with however many stars you like, as long as it's 5, and review wherever you found us. If you haven't bought any Lawfare swag, you should go to thelawfarestore.com, where all the swag is available. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineers this week were Matthew Kahn and Michaela Fogel. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.